From Heroes Worldwide, this is FSN.
Thank you very much, Simon. Oh, well, it's been a nice afternoon here in Salford. The sun has come out a little bit and it's altogether less gloomy than it has been in recent days. That's your weather update. It is the BBG. How you doing? Welcome to Wednesday's programme. And it's the phone-in.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
Love the phone-ins, me. Phone-in time.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
I'll be giving you the contact details in a moment, but they are on the Twitter for Richie Allen, the Richie Allen Twitter thing, and the Facebook page for the Richie Allen Show. There is a nice meme with the contact details. So in around about 30 minutes' time, I'll be taking your calls. Priority, as usual, given to people who are brand new callers or ones we haven't heard from in a long time. So do please ring me and give us your thoughts on whatever. Lockdown, furlough schemes, I'm happy to hear from you. You know that? Yes. And I do love the phone-in, so I'm glad. I've given it plenty of notice. I talked about it yesterday. I had the memes running or posting. They were posted yesterday and today and all the rest of it. Let me give you the contact details. Don't waste your time trying to get through now, because I won't even switch it on till just after 5:30, right? Because we've got a news roundup to go through. Do you want the contact details? Here they are. All right. If you are using Skype, this is the best way to reach the BBG. If I ever do start referring to myself in the third person, please kill me. If you want to chat with me via Skype, my Skype handle is Chat with Richie. That's all one word, Chat with Richie, or I-C-H-I-E. If you want to phone me in the UK, it is Manchester 0161 818 2018. 0161 818 2018. If you're calling from outside the UK, it is +44 161 818 2018. But the meme can be found if you go to twitter.com, look for the Richie Allen Show. Alright? Chat with Richie on Skype. Skype won't cost you a dime. Won't cost you a dime, man. Not even a dime it'll cost you. Well, apart from the electricity and your broadband bills, I suppose. Yeah. Right. What's been happening today? We live in a police state. Nothing new there. I don't think anybody can deny it now. I've been watching civil liberties being eroded steadily over the years, not just here, not just in Ireland, but everywhere, right? And here we are now in 2020, and the country has been in house arrest for 3 months, 100 days, to protect the vulnerable from a virus which isn't much worse than seasonal flu. And all of the statistics bear that out. That isn't my opinion. That is not my slanted, biased view of what's happening. That is a fact. And socialists say, well, he's going to start that again. I'm not going to start that again. I'm just going to tell you that people who call themselves socialists, people who probably can't even spell it, are cheerleading the news from Airbus, from EasyJet, from John Lewis, from retailers all over the country. The tens of thousands of jobs are gone. What socialist would applaud that? Historically, because I can't think of one. I've been racking my brains. And the furlough scheme, which will destroy firms. Do you even get the furlough scheme? And by you, I mean the fake socialists who want to extend it. Do you even know what it means? Well, what the furlough scheme is you take a firm that's been doing okay, plodding along, just about staying in the black, employing 10 people, 20 people, 50 people, sometimes hundreds of people. You tell them to close, cease trading, and begin to rack up debt because you are no longer trading. Close because of something which isn't much worse than seasonal flu. And we, the government, because we're very, very, very generous, we will borrow billions to pay your staff 80% of their wages. But here's the kicker. When all of this is over, you, the firm that we insisted close your doors, you'll have to pay for it. So bosses of tens of thousands of small businesses in the country were like, well, we were just surviving, just turning over a few bob, just looking after our staff, just about solvent. Now we're fucked, basically. And people calling themselves socialists are calling for that scheme to be extended. And you don't have to be Albert Einstein, you don't have to be a genius to realise that that's going to finish small businesses all over the country. Socialists. Rather than hammer the government for introducing the lockdown to begin with, the fake left are hammering the government for not locking down quickly enough or for easing the lockdown. Can you get your head around that? Try and get your head around that. It was a slam dunk for the Labour Party, allegedly the party of the working class. It was a slam dunk for them to insist that no lockdown be introduced. But no, socialism is dead. There's no such thing as socialism in the UK. Labour could have hammered Johnson at the very beginning on the flip-flop done by him and his advisor Neil Ferguson, saying one day this virus is harmful, but it isn't very serious, that we'd have to treat it with caution, as we would a seasonal flu. Next day, they were saying we have to stop the economy and put people under house arrest. Now, rather than take that on, the left would rather say we need more lockdown, and they would rather attack the Prime Minister on the basis that his hesitancy cost lives. Now, as a socialist, I have no time for Boris Johnson, or any of them, really. It's astonishing to me. And I am the last real socialist with a public profile, however limited my public profile might be. I'm the last real socialist standing in the UK today. No socialist, no trade unionist could support what's been happening in this country and what will happen as it gets progressively worse. And today it was announced 11,000 jobs gone. Retail, aviation, John Lewis I mentioned, the snack bar operator Upper Crust, 5,000 jobs going. Airbus will cut 15,000 jobs worldwide, including 1,700 in the UK. Please listen to John Harrison, the chair of Airbus in the UK, talking about 1,700 jobs going here. It's insane because of what he says to the BBC. Listen to John Harrison from Airbus.
Just let me first explain, you know, why this is a terrible day for us. 40% reduction in our production and in our deliveries in 2020 and 2021. So, you know, this is an absolute dramatic situation. We're in July. In January, we were planning on delivering 880 aircraft. We were actually having difficulty meeting the demand. So we're in exception.
Yeah, you've just got to hear that again. In January, things were looking up.
In July, in January, we were planning on delivering 880 aircraft.
880 aircraft. We couldn't keep up with the demand. Our workers were busy as beavers, and they were all doing well. But now...
We were actually having difficulty meeting the demand. So we're in exceptional circumstances, and... You know, Airbus is all about people, so this is a very painful day for us. But we're trying to ensure that Airbus will have a sustainable future, and that we're actually there when the recovery takes place. So the 1,700 people will be spread between, as you said, Filton in Bristol and Broughton. Broughton is mostly manufacturing of wings. All the wings on all the Airbus aircraft come from Wales. And the engineering centre. But I can't give details about the actual distribution. We'll be talking to our trade unions first about that before we speak publicly.
That's life. That's what all the people say. 1 week you can't fulfil your orders. The next week you're letting go 1,700 people. Tyranny. Sky News is reporting that 36 more areas could be told to lock down again and not open bars and restaurants and hairdressers on Saturday. You know that Leicester was told to lock down again yesterday. About 330,000 people in Leicester or thereabouts. This virus, whatever it is, all the stats say it's about as bad as a bad flu season in terms of hospitalisation and mortality rates. We're in July. And even the conservative media is refusing to challenge this stuff now. Here's Julia Hartley Brewer on Talk Radio speaking to a virologist or a virologist called Simon Clark. Let's blame the new lockdowns on those who didn't socially distance over the last 3 months, eh? Why not? Why not?
This isn't a surprise, is it? I mean, this is basic stuff. Lots of people meeting up, not social distancing during the lockdown. It's going to cause a spike.
Absolutely. Where lots of people get together.
Is she asking him or telling him, you know? It's extraordinary what's happened to journalism, eh?
Where they mix, there is the opportunity for the virus to spread. It really is as simple as that. That's all we're talking about. This thing loves to hop from person to person, and it does it with incredible ease. There are very few things that we know about that can do it quite so well. And that's all it requires, a lot of people getting together and mixing and not being socially distant.
Yeah, I mean, and are you confident that people aren't taking this seriously enough? I mean, lots of the concerns about what's happened in Leicester have been centered around the idea that actually people weren't socially distancing in certain areas of the city. People weren't obeying it enough. Some people working through. There's some talk about meat packing factories where the conditions are rife, you know, cold and wet, but also some garment factories continuing working and not socially distancing. The lessons are very clear here, and yet it does seem that some people just are ignoring them.
Is that a question again? Is there a question in there? She's just repeating what he already said and endorsing it. Yes, people aren't taking it seriously and it's spreading. What's he going to say to that?
Ignoring them.
Yeah, my understanding is that in Leicester in particular, it's thought that some people just haven't been socially distancing, and that's what's driving the infection. We'll get an idea of who those people are, because, of course, they're the ones that prove positive in tests, and their children as well. And that's another interesting question, what's happening with their children, are the ones that pick up the infection. Where are they getting this? The test and tracing people need to dig much deeper in this.
Dig much deeper. And what will we do? I mean, there was a threat implied at the end of that, wasn't there? Was it just me? Or was there a threat implied at the tail end of that little speech there by Simon Clark? Listen.
Haven't been socially distancing, and that's what's driving the infection. We'll get an idea of who those people are, because, of course, they're the ones that prove positive in tests. And
we're getting an idea of who those people are, because they prove positive in tests. Those who didn't socially distance. Then he says it's fairly, you know, an interesting question is about their children.
And their children as well. That's another interesting question. What's happening with their children are the ones that pick up the infection. Where are they getting this? The test and tracing people need to dig much deeper.
There is a threat implied there somewhere. And I'm not sensationalising what he's saying. He's basically saying that we might have to look at what we do about people who are spreading this virus because they won't do what they're told. Julia Hartley Brewer is like a cheap nodding dog. They used to be popular on the back windows of cars, didn't they? Just nodding along. No questions, nary a question. More on the left and how dreadful the left is, the fake left. Prime Minister's Questions takes place every Wednesday at lunchtime at Westminster. Here's an exchange between Keir Starmer, Labour leader, and Boris Johnson. You know who he is. Starmer's looking for opportunities to attack Johnson for not acting more quickly and attacking him for being too hasty in easing the lockdown. This is shocking stuff, this. You'll hear Starmer, then you will hear the Prime Minister.
I do support the government's decision of Monday, but I think the 4,000 businesses and the 160 schools that are now shut might take some persuading that the government acted quickly enough. One of the problems in Leicester was the local authority only had half of the data. They had data for pillar one COVID tests. That's NHS, care workers and tests in hospitals. They didn't have pillar two tests, the wider tests in the community. Now, that may sound technical, but what that meant was that the local authority thought there were 80 positive tests in the last fortnight when the real figure was 944. The local authority was only given the real figure last Thursday. So there was a lost week whilst the virus was spreading. There are now real fears, Mr. Speaker, of further local lockdowns across the country. Can the Prime Minister give a cast-iron guarantee today that no other local authority will ever be put in that position again?
36 places might be told to lock down again in the next couple of days.
Again.
It's the damage this is going to do to people, psychologically, to their health, to their well-being, to their futures, to their children's future. And the Labour Party, the so-called party of the worker, is chastising the Prime Minister for putting lives at risk by not locking places down quicker. Yeah. What does Johnson say?
Prime Minister.
Well, actually, Mr. Speaker, I'm afraid the right honourable gentleman is mistaken, because both Pillar 1 and Pillar 2 data have been shared not just with Leicester, but with all authorities, Mr. Speaker, across the country. And we did in Leicester exactly what we did, for instance, Mr. Speaker, in Kirklees or in Bradford or in Weston-super-Mare or other places where very effective whack-a-mole strategies have been put in place for reasons that I think the House will probably understand. There were particular problems in Leicester in implementing the advice and getting people to understand what was necessary to do. But let's face it, we've had to act. The government has acted, and he wants to know whether we'll act in future, Mr. Speaker, to ensure that we protect the health of the entire country. And I can tell him that we will. Absolutely, Mr. Speaker.
Yeah, they're planning to keep locking places down until there's nothing left. Sky News spoke with a woman this afternoon from Edinburgh University, a woman called Devi Sridhar. At least that's how I think it's pronounced. She's a professor and chair of global public health at the University of Edinburgh. Just another useful idiot, basically. All day there's been uproar over Donald Trump buying up an antiviral drug. This has been a big story. You heard it in the news at the top of the hour. This is a drug, remdesivir, which was developed for use against Ebola. But apparently it's useful in helping people recover quickly from coronavirus. Right? Gets them back on their feet a few days quicker than they would otherwise be back on their feet. So remdesivir, and Donald Trump, the selfish bastard, has secured the next 3 months' supply of it. And that's been in the news today. So Devi Sridhar from University of Edinburgh Public Health, she was asked, if we win the race to a vaccine, will we in the UK get priority to it? That's important, right?
Well, that all has to be negotiated in the hope that would be that actually, you know, different governments did commit at the World Health Assembly this May that vaccines would be a global public good. China committed that if it discovered a vaccine, it would share it with the world. But there's obviously one thing to talk about it and to have rhetoric, and it's another thing to actually see it. So I think what this really shows is the need to have hard conversations, which is how many doses could be manufactured? What is the allocation process? To what countries would it go? How would you roll it out? Because otherwise, once the vaccine is there, it's not like everyone's going to get it the day we figure out that actually it's effective. There's a long process to go from there to making sure that it's manufactured, how it's distributed, and who gets it first when you have the whole world.
What? Wait for this now.
World, you know, almost 8 billion people.
8 billion people. This is beautiful. This is why I recorded this clip. Couldn't make this up.
World, you know, almost 8 billion people looking and saying, actually, we want access to that too.
Yeah. Okay, Dr. Devi Sridhar, good to talk to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
And then she says, thanks for coming on. 8 billion people wanted, said the idiot from Edinburgh University. Yeah, thanks for coming on to tell us that. That's lovely. Jesus wept. Before we move on, I've only got one more story for you this afternoon. I'm not going to get into Facebook and advertisers. You know, don't you? There's some of the biggest corporations in the world are suspending their business with Facebook. Advertisers are withdrawing their advertisements from Facebook to encourage Facebook to do more to get rid of hate speech. Yeah, I'm not getting into it because we talked about it too often. You might want to get into it in the phone-in. But I'm going to tell you the contact details now to give you a chance. Don't bother ringing me till I tell you to, by the way, because it's not on yet. But the contact details for the programme, if you should like to speak to me in a few minutes, and I really hope you do. The contact details are very simple. My Skype handle is Chat with Richie. Chat with R-I-C-H-I-E, all one word, Chat with Richie. If you're calling inside the UK, it is 0161-818-2018. That's 0161-818-2018. If you are calling from outside the country, it is +44-161-818-2018. But importantly, if you are on Skype, it's the best way to contact me because it doesn't cost you too much. It is Chat with Richie on Skype. There you are. Right. Good job. Ah, well. We tried. Today has been a bit more newsy, hasn't it? The old monologue's been a bit more newsy. I do try to make you laugh. I do try to keep your spirits up as best as I can. And there was something this morning which both myself and the oft-mentioned, herself or indoors, we laughed pretty hard at this morning. You know that in Florida, they're closing the beaches down for Independence Day weekend. It's like the script from Jaws, isn't it? Martin Brody, Chief Brody, you can't close the beaches down. We got thousands of people coming in from upstate New York. Fuck the shark, open the beaches. Right, okay. Well, they're closing the beaches in Florida. And I had belly laughs. They were talking about this. Sky has a reporter running reports from Florida. And they're going to close all the beaches because of a spike in that bastard of a virus. So a Sky journalist made a little 6-minute film about it. And in the film, she spoke with Floridian man John Delgado. And this is that moment when you wonder, am I dreaming this stuff? And will I wake up from it? Maybe I'm in a coma. Maybe 4 months ago when I was running down Liverpool Street in Salford, I was hit by some blind as a bat, crazy battle-ax driving a fucking Mini Cooper, a 97-year-old woman whose license expired 20 years ago. Yes, a misogynistic bastard. Maybe she knocked me up into the air and maybe I'm in a coma and I'm dreaming this. This is one of those moments. Listen to Floridian John Delgado.
John Delgado has been at the sharp end of the virus from the start. He's a frontline staffer for a food bank. He's been sleeping in a tent in his garden for months to avoid infecting his wife, mother-in-law, 3 sons and grandson inside.
He's been sleeping in a tent for months. And they showed you the tent. It's right next to the back door. For months to avoid contacting his children, his grandparents, his wife, and his mother-in-law, because he works day by day at a food bank. Been sleeping in a tent in his garden for months. You hear that, Tom?
No. Could you repeat it? Because I can't believe my fucking ears.
Yeah, in a tent right next to his back door for months. And well, John, God love him, he's not happy because he's making such a unique sacrifice in living in a tent next to his back door, not hugging his children or his wife, but everybody else has fucked it up for John.
Because of how the surge came and all this, it's frustrating for me because I want this to be able so I can go permanently inside, just stay there and hug my family, my kids and all. But as in for, I don't think it's a waste what I'm doing, because the bottom line is protecting my family, regardless of what decisions made by our government officials.
You've been living in this tent just by your home for more than 2 months.
Just by his home, it's next to his back door. You can find this on Sky's website.
And then you see these young people in the bars, the restaurants, they're not wearing masks, they're not social distancing.
When I saw that, I just put my head down and I just said, you know what, this is going to get worse. This is going to get worse. People are going to, a lot of more people are going to die. The virus is going to keep spreading. And the hospital is going to get full. And you know how I know that's happening?
How do you know this is happening, John?
Happening because our food lines, when they first started, miles. Towards 2 months or something, the lines are like getting smaller, getting more control. Look at it now, miles again. starting all over again, the lines.
He's talking about his food bank. Well, of course the lines to your food bank are getting longer, John. Mother of DBs.
Do you feel angry?
Disappointed. I thought we knew better.
He is bearing the burden of a crisis out of control.
He's bearing the burden, John. John, get out of that tent, you stupid fucker. Go and have a shower and a shave. Go upstairs and give the wife the seeing to of her lifetime. Make it so that she can't walk straight until Halloween, John. Be a man. Living in a tent next to your back door for months because of a fucking flu virus. And after all of this, millions of jobs to be lost in the UK. Worst depression for hundreds of years. What could you do to make it worse? Well, you could always say to 3 million British national people overseas in Hong Kong that they can come and live here. Here's the Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab.
The Prime Minister and the government are crystal clear. The United Kingdom will keep its word. We will live up to our responsibilities to the people of Hong Kong. And I can tell the House that after further detailed discussions with my right honourable friend the Home Secretary, I can now confirm we will proceed to honour our commitment to change the arrangements for those holding BNO status. And I can update honourable members that we have worked with ministers right across Whitehall and we have now developed proposals for a bespoke immigration route for BNOs and their dependents. We will grant BNOs 5 years limited leave to remain with the right to work or study. After these 5 years, they'll be able to apply for settled status. And after a further 12 months with settled status, they will be able to apply for citizenship. This is a special, bespoke set of arrangements developed for the unique circumstances we faced and in light of our historic commitment to the people of Hong Kong. All of those with BNO status will be eligible, as will their family dependents, who are usually resident in Hong Kong. And the Home Office will put in place a simple, streamlined application process. And I can reassure honourable members there will be no quotas on numbers.
Yes, no quotas on numbers. So in theory, you wreck the economy, put millions and millions of people out of work, prepare to inflict austerity on them as that was previously unimaginable, and let's start inviting in possibly hundreds of thousands of people from Hong Kong. Dominic Raab.
What kind of fuckery are you?
Yeah. Listen, here's the contact details. It's on a meme, which is on Twitter. It's on Facebook. It's Chat with Richie on Skype. It's 0161 818 2018 if you're calling from inside the UK. If you're outside the UK, it's very simple. It's plus 44 161 818 2018. And I'll be taking your calls in a couple of minutes. This is the Richie Allen Radio Show live from Salford in Greater Manchester. The BBG, not the BBC, Europe's most listened to independent radio show. You are very welcome to it. Wednesday, July the 1st, 2020. Summer is here. Right, without any further ado, let's get rid of Chris Rea there. The Road to Hell, 27 minutes to 6 on Wednesday afternoon. Lots of calls coming in already. Be patient. We'll go as long as we need to go. I'll get as many people on as I possibly can. I am going to give priority as best as I can to people calling for the very first time, or people we haven't heard from in ages. And we'll try and move it along as quickly as we can. All right, first up, caller, welcome to the programme. Who have I got?
Hi, my name's Louise. I'm from Save Our Rights UK.
How you doing, Louise? You're very welcome. Nice to have you on the programme. How are you?
I am very well, thank you. I'm thoroughly enjoying this lockdown, as we all know. We've been campaigning ever since the lockdown was extended against this dystopian nightmare that we're experiencing. But since a few weeks ago, we realised that actually what needs to change isn't that we need lockdown lifting. We need a whole system reform. This system doesn't work for us. It's not a democracy. It doesn't give anybody a voice. And the whole system is broken. So we've been working very hard on developing a new, I have a history in politics, so developing a new political system, a new taxation system, a new banking system, and we're working with whistleblowers in the NHS to reform that too, and build something that could be workable and replace what we've currently got.
When you say, this sounds very interesting, Louise. When you say we, who is we?
So it's I set up the group and I am working with a select few people who have come to me. We've got people who are economists and finances, people who've worked in the NHS, and then people who've got a legal background. I've got a political background, and we're just coordinating and looking at all the areas where there's corruption in this country and looking at how we can fix that. Because until that is fixed and until we have a real democracy, nothing is going to get better, and we can always revert back to this. That's what they've proven.
Can you give Louise, can you give us a couple of bullet points, a couple of things that might you might do differently, or one or two of the policies that you've been talking about in the group?
Yeah, so, well, one of the things that you really don't need is you don't need party politics and you don't need MPs. Both are now obsolete and outdated. You know, they were necessary back in the day when people had to, you know, the MPs would trot on their horse back up to Parliament to give the information, get the information, trot back down to their constituency and pass over the information. We don't need that now. The whole system is much more accessible. But what we need is we do need some sort of governance, and we need people in roles like Secretary of State. But why not? Why do we not get a choice about who is our education secretary or who's our health secretary? Would anybody have picked Matt Hancock for the job? I'm not sure we would have. And what's his qualification? He doesn't have a qualification. So why not elect people directly into the Secretary of State roles based on their own personal manifesto? And then because they're elected in on a personal one individual basis, if they don't stick to it, then they lose their job. Whereas at the moment, people are protected by party politics, because even if you don't like your MP, if they stand for the party that you usually vote for, you're likely to still vote that way. So, and then once they're in, they don't have to listen to you anymore. Whereas if you've elected somebody in directly and on their own individual merits, and then they don't listen to the public, then they won't get in again and they'll lose their job. So they'd be much more accountable. And then also decentralise as much of the governance as possible. Hand it back to the people, give people a voice. The Swiss model is very interesting. And so we're taking, and some of it's reflecting that. But
where is it, Louise? Where is this discussion going on? Is it going on social media, Facebook, I'm thinking?
Yeah, so I've got a group called Save Our Rights UK. So we've got a Facebook group, there's a Facebook page, a Twitter page, but the majority of it is in the Facebook group. And we've got, so we do like video calls, group video calls. So we've got another one tomorrow night so that we can discuss what's happening.
Right, let me make a deal with you. Let me make a deal with you. This is going to go on too long, right? And I've got dozens of calls coming in, so I'll make a deal with you.
Yeah.
I'm very interested in this. So I'll get in touch with you and I'll arrange you to come back on the programme with me next week or whenever it's convenient to you, and we'll have a proper chat about it. We'll get people talking about it on Twitter and we can get into it there, because there's obviously a lot to this and I'm genuinely interested in it. But if we carry on, we could be here for 20, 25 minutes and there are a lot of calls trying to get in. So Louise, I'm very interested in that. So thanks for calling in about it.
Well, wonderful. Thanks so much. Yeah. Please get in contact.
No, I will. And we'll arrange that chat and we'll make time for it on the programme here and we'll do it properly. Okay.
Wonderful.
Thanks, Louise. Great. Thanks for your time today. Thanks for calling in. Lovely to hear from you. Yeah, I love stuff like this. I love ideas, solutions. I'm going to take another call on the phone, and then I've got two or three people on Skype I want to get in. It is, of course, Chat with Richie on Skype, and it is 0161 418 2018 on the telephone. And by the way, if you want to find Louise, she said the group is Save Our Rights UK. Save Our Rights UK on Facebook. If you want to check that out there, we'll get her back in the programme right soon. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Caller, you are live. Welcome to the programme.
Hello, is that me you're talking to, Richie?
It is. Is that my friend in America?
It is. It's Scottish John here in Austin, Texas.
Ah, Scottish John, it's been ages, mate. How are you? How are things?
I know, yeah. Well, I'll try and be as quick as possible here. I've been having trouble with arthritis for a while. And recently I was watching one of those Del Bigtree videos, and he did an interview with Dolores Cahill, you know, the professor that's based in Dublin there.
That's right, UCD, yeah.
And she talked about this hydroxychloroquine and how they tested it on... Now, I had to check her figures because I thought at first she said 68,000, but she actually said over 680,000 elderly people in Italy were tested with this hydroxychloroquine, and all but four of these people found improvements. So it just so happened that I had just started a treatment for my arthritis. They were giving me these infusions, and the doctor had already told me before we started, he says, there's a possibility that you could get cancer from this treatment. And I thought, well, that's very comforting. But anyway, I went ahead and I had a couple of one-hour-long visits where they stick this thing in your arm and away you go. And then I came to the first of a four-hour session. And a couple of days after this four-hour session, I noticed that something was going wrong with my plumbing, Richie.
Okay.
So I decided to stop this. And I called up my GP, who's someone I've only seen twice, actually. And you'll love his name. Richie, my doctor is called Dr. Cranky.
Is that right?
I kid you not. Anyway, I didn't get talking to him, but I got a phone conversation, a phone appointment with a colleague of his. And I said, look, I want to try this hydroxychloroquine for my arthritis. And he reluctantly got me a prescription for it. And then he wanted me to he wanted me to do a load of stuff. He wanted me to go back and see the surgeon that put a pacemaker into me. He wanted me to go and see an ophthalmologist for my eyesight because he thought this hydroxychloroquine was going to bloody kill me in every way imaginable, right? So,
by the way, just before you go on, for listeners who haven't heard of hydroxychloroquine, it's been in the news quite a bit because the President of the United States endorsed it as being fairly useful in dealing with coronavirus. That's important to, in case anybody isn't aware of that. And there's been a lot of talk about it, a lot of Donald Trump supporters saying that this is being suppressed. A lot of people say it isn't safe, but this is fascinating. So he reluctantly gave you a prescription for it, but then he taught you to get in touch with your other physicians because he thought it was going to do untold damage to your body. Did it?
Yeah.
Is the question.
No. Well, here's the... Now, I said to him, well, this rheumatologist that I've seen is actually just leaving Austin. He's moving to Wisconsin. And, well, he says, we have a rheumatologist here. Why don't you make an appointment? I say, okay, I'll do that. So I go down and I see this rheumatologist there at the surgery. And he's a Japanese fella as well, a bit younger than the guy I'd been seeing. Well, this guy turned out to be a bit of an obnoxious bugger, Richie. He told me flat out that he wouldn't prescribe me this hydroxychloroquine again. He didn't want me to have that. But they gave me some tests, and he kept arguing with me. I says, well, I've been diagnosed as having rheumatoid arthritis. And he says, well, it doesn't sound to me like you have. And I says, well, here's a kicker. And I've told this story to a lot of people. I was first diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis back in 1990 when I was living in London. And I think it was my mother had it bad and my grandmother as well. But anyway, I'd had it for about 2 years and I happened to be working with a guy one night. He was new. We were doing catering work in a big hotel in London. And here was this new guy and I got chatting to him. Well, he had this book with him and it was a translation of ancient Chinese medicine by a fella. And it was called The Tao of Health, Sex and Longevity. And there was a cure recommended for arthritis was to eat up to 3 pounds of black seeded grapes for up to 5 days. So I went for the max, Richie. I started on the Monday, ate 3 pounds, chewed the seeds, swallowed them. By the end of the week, man, I was brand new. I was as clean as a whistle. The arthritis was gone.
Black seedless grapes.
Seeded.
Oh, excuse me, seeded. Black seeded grapes.
Yeah. Yeah, and you chew, the important thing is to chew and swallow the seeds. Now, what happened was years later, fast forward here to 2007, I got married to a girl over here and I had to go through this little procedure to get permanent residence status, part of which was I had to take 2 vaccinations. And I
yeah,
did
we mentioned
not want
this
to
before,
do
yeah.
this.
Yeah, I remember we talked about this before, the vaccinations, right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So now, what's the current situation is now, I'm noticing, I mean, I've been on this hydroxychloroquine now for about 3 weeks approximately. And
how do you take
ago,
it, John, before, because I'm getting, there's a lot of calls coming in, I don't want to be rushing you,
right.
But I want to move on.
Yeah.
How do you take this hydroxychloroquine? It's in tablet form, presumably?
It's like a little pill, like an aspirin. Little white pill.
And you've been having it for 3 weeks? You've been on it for 3 weeks, and what has it done for you?
I finally started noticing a difference. There's a lot of relief in my hands.
Is that
and
right?
My right hip is a lot more flexible than it was. I can move it without a lot of pain, you know?
That's fascinating. So, that's fascinating.
It's not 100% gone, but it's a marked improvement, mate. Yeah.
What would you say? What would you say? 30, 40% improvement, would you say?
I would say that's a fair estimate, yeah.
And just before we move on, because what you just told us is hugely important. So you began back in the early 1990s taking seeded black grapes. What was the quantity again, and how often did you eat the grapes?
It recommended up a maximum of £3 per day, and
that's a lot of grapes,
right? A maximum of 5 days. So you're talking about £15 of black seeded grapes.
And that worked for you. So presumably, if you kept doing that, it would continue to work.
Well, here's the kicker, Richie. I was able to get some black seeded grapes here, and I went through the same regime, and it didn't work. And I figured, well, whatever was in those vaccinations that I took, that knocked out the effectiveness of the grapes, I'm afraid.
And what about the grapes now in the US? How could you be sure that they're not Monsanto grapes, you know?
Well, this is what I was having a conversation with a guy in the grocery store the other day. I said, how do you grow seedless grapes? I don't understand that.
Yeah.
I thought all fruit and vegetables grew from seeds.
Yeah, but they patent the seeds, and they designed them not to, well, basically, the Terminator seeds. That's what they are, yeah. Terminator. John, yeah. Listen, we'll catch up again, mate. We'll have longer to talk because you've got some fascinating opinions. Thanks for telling us that. That was John, Scottish John, in Houston. Loads and loads of calls coming in, right? So, let's get to Alan. A lot of first-time people trying to get on the programme today. It is the Richie Allen Radio Show, the Global Phone-In, live on Wednesday, the 1st of July. Summer is here. It's very warm, muggy this afternoon. Not very bright at the moment, but very muggy. Hey, Alan, you're very welcome to the programme, mate. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. Yeah, hi.
Nice to be with you. Where are you based, my friend?
I'm in South London.
Oh, you're in South London. I know we tried to get you on before and it didn't work. I'm glad you're on, Alan. The floor is yours, mate. What would you like to say?
Yeah, thanks. First, I just wanted to say I didn't actually know that you're a socialist, and I appreciated what you said at the beginning because I'm a lifelong socialist, and I've been getting more and more into the alternative media. And usually, you know, you guys in the alternative media are extremely anti-socialist. And as you say, it's like people giving socialism a bad name who don't even know what the word socialism actually means. I mean, all of this kind of Black Lives Matter stuff, right? I mean, how can, like, identity politics without class analysis is just completely goes against socialism. So I was just kind of inspired to call in and just say, well, yeah, thanks for giving a positive shout out to socialism.
Alan? What's happened, do you think, in 25, 30, 40 years to the definition of, to socialism as we understand it? I'm amazed when I meet people who have done well for themselves and they've got it into their heads that socialism means that their hard-earned money would be taken from them and redistributed. And I tell them to look at socialism in Latin America and in South America and how, when socialist governments came to power in those countries, I always mention Allende, of course, from Chile, that it doesn't happen. They don't take money from people who've done well and redistribute it. They do not do that. What's happened to socialism and how people perceive it in the last 30, 40 years?
I think...
Big question.
Since the 1980s, right, because of Thatcherism, it's the kind of the whole discourse has gotten kind of stuck in what they call the center. And the genuine socialist left has just kind of essentially disappeared. And I kind of feel like all of this identity politics stuff, I don't want to be conspiratorial about it, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was actually being used to undermine socialism and make it all look like a bunch of mad people, you know, cultural Marxism and all this stuff, which has nothing to do with actual socialism. I guess another thing on top of that is how Tony Blair just screwed over, you know, the traditional socialists of that time. And we socialists now, I'm sorry to say this because you're going to disapprove, but I'm a Labour Party member and I have been for a long time.
Yeah.
And we are digging ourselves further into a hole by demonizing our traditional voters and making them, you know, basically pushing them more to the right. And I've been trying to tell people this for years now, like that you know, people who want to vote to leave the European Union are not stupid. The old school socialists of the past wanted to leave the European Union, and back then it was more of a right-wing thing, right, to kind of get the cheap labor from other countries. And it's changed, and it's I tried to explain this to people, and but some of them, especially the ones my age, they're so stuck in their mind about like just how stupid and wretched the people we used to call the salt of the earth are, and it really is very dispiriting. And I feel like it's kind of like a divide and conquer strategy, right? Because people like Chuka Amuna, he surely knew that by trying to push the Labour Party to support leaving the European Union, that we were basically going to be screwing the party for the next generation. So I feel like this is just divide and conquer. And it's the same with like Black Lives Matter and all of this. Like, it's like, you know, if there was, I was listening to your show from yesterday, earlier today, and you were talking about how if 1 million of us actually kind of went up on Parliament and demanded that these people get out, then there's nothing that they could do about it. But that's like class analysis. To know that, right?
Yeah,
but if they're bitterly bickering about like transgenderism and how Black people have it worse than white people, tell someone from Blackpool, a working class white guy, that you have white privilege, then they're not going to understand what you're talking about. It doesn't make sense to them, right? Because they don't have any privilege. And if we're just kind of bickering about these issues, then there's not going to be any class analysis. And then when they're not going to have the whole working class, by which I mean all the working people.
Regardless of what they look like. See, this is brilliant, Alan. I wish to Christ you'd been on the program in the past. This is bang on. Class is omitted from the discussion. And the point you make about Blackpool, and you could talk about South Shields, you could talk Redcar, Middlesbrough. Of course you've got white working class people there. I could talk about parts of Waterford City, where I come from. You know, I grew up in Ballybeg, a working class housing estate. Again, salt of the earth, the best people in the world, but always struggled. Don't tell those people about, you know, you've got some sort of advantage because you're white. These are... And while all of this is happening, this lunacy, this agenda that we talk about on the programme, you know, to force wealth, land, real wealth, all in the one direction, you know, to the same people, to the same tiny group of people, while the rest of us suffer, it just carries on, doesn't it? It's made easier, basically.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, something I really like about David Icke is that he often talks about how this is just divide and conquer, and he doesn't want to get kind of drawn into the identity narrative. And I think that's kind of what it really boils down to. It's identity without class analysis. And people like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, they, you know, they understood right, that this is... Well, Malcolm X later on in his life understood this, that like, this is a struggle for everybody. And unless like you're overturning the entire system and the whole working class is uniting with each other, then it doesn't mean anything. And so it makes me feel really bad. Like I people call me far right. I've been getting called far right.
Imagine that. Because you're expressing traditional socialist values, you get called far right. The most important thing anybody has said to me in weeks, You said to me a few minutes ago, trade unionists, socialists in the 1980s feared the influx of a semi-skilled or low-skilled workforce from elsewhere. Not because they were bigots or because they were little Englanders. They knew that people like my family, because I come from a working class family, they knew that we would be screwed, Alan, didn't they? They knew this. It's not right wing, it's common sense.
Well, even Jeremy Corbyn knew that.
Yeah.
As you've said many times, he changed his tune on the European Union reluctantly. But this is the crazy thing, right? Like, you know, yesterday when you were talking about how, you know, the coronavirus, like people losing their jobs and everything, we on the left are supposed to be the ones outraged about this.
Yeah.
Yet somehow that narrative now, when I talk about how the workers are the ones losing, like, so I've got a pretty good job and I'm working from home. I'm not the one losing out. I'm going to be very comfortable. But when I talk about how the people who are going to be damaged the most from this are working class people, they're going to be screwed over. People actually call me far right. And it's just bizarre. I'm not like, how has this switch happened? You know, it's crazy. So I'm inclined to think that this is probably deliberate, because, like you say, divide and conquer. Like, it must be.
And it's working, Alan. It's bloody well working. If you don't mind, I'm going to move it on. I'm thrilled that you came on the programme today. It might be something, I've got your details now. That's something we could explore, because you're obviously experienced. And listen, I don't think any less of you at all that you're a Labour Party member. Why would I? I was a follower of left-wing politicians in Waterford, whether they were Socialist Workers' Party, whether they were the Irish Labour Party, Sinn Féin, of course, the Workers' Party. So no, man, I don't think that I know any more than you. I understand why people like you are still trying to, you know, fight it from the inside, and I respect it, Alan, I really do. And it'll be nice to talk to you again in the very near future, if that's okay.
Yeah, of course. I'd love to.
Brilliant, Alan. Thanks for getting in touch today. That was Alan. I'd love to spend a lot more time with Alan on this subject. But there's so many calls coming in. And I've got an idea now of where we are call-wise. You often hear me mention on Twitter when I'm reading the tweets, I often mention Bass Ninja, who's a bass player, a musician. He's never been on the programme. But he's here today, I think. He tweets the programme. He's never been on the phone in. Before we say hello to him, the Skype name is Chat with Richie, all one word, Chat with Richie. The phone number inside the UK is 0161 418 2018, and it is plus 44161 418 2018 from outside the UK. It's Bass Ninja on the Richie Allen Show. How are you doing?
I'm not bad there, Richie, mate.
Good.
My name's Alan, you can call me Alan.
How are you doing? I was going to ask, yeah, Alan, you're welcome. I can probably guess where you are. Where are you?
I'm in the mighty town of Liverpool,
oh,
mate.
Jesus Christ. And you're a Red too, aren't you?
I am, yeah, but I'm not going to bring that up because, you know, I don't want to do that for all
do
the
bring it up,
and
do
all
bring
the
up.
International
best,
audience don't really give a shit
best,
about football.
Best team in country, and thoroughly deserved. To win the league. Good to have you on, Alan. Really is, mate. Nice to be putting a voice to the tweets. So, you know how it works. You get to say whatever you want, so off you go.
Yeah, I just thought I'd call in. It was interesting to listen to the First Lady. That reminded me of the last, say, half an hour of Zeitgeist attending. But the reason I've rang up, basically, Rich, is I work in the entertainment industry. Obviously, those who tweet realise I'm a bass player. But I'm also a professional lighting technician when I work for a company which is based in Manchester. So I imagine my life in Manchester.
Yeah.
No, the Manx are great. The Manx are great. But that business was started by a bunch of guys who used to do the stuff in the Hacienda and stuff like that. And I got a letter off them on Monday. And I've been furloughed since March 14th. And that letter broke my heart, to be honest with you, because basically they're saying, we're going to go as long as we can. We're looking like possibly retrading again in April next year. And that just breaks my heart because that business, when I joined it 3 years ago, it was still small. It's grown. It was doing all the Pride festivals for the shame of them. They were doing a Conservative Party for bollocks in Manchester. But hey, you know, money's money.
Money's money, too, right. Yeah.
Yeah, I never let me work on it for some reason. I don't know why that is. Maybe it's because they think I'm a crazy conspiracy theorist. I don't know.
Or they know the likelihood of you being a Conservative Party supporter coming from Liverpool is very unlikely, Alan. That's probably more like it.
Lips on a fish, I should say.
Yeah, exactly. And we're hearing today, right across the country, obviously catering, obviously entertainment, pubs and clubs, bars, hospitality, retail, hemorrhaging jobs. You and people who work in your industry, because live music is basically on hiatus. It's worrying times, Alan, right?
Yeah, it's gone. I mean, I read a friend who works down in Oxford. I used to be a Bechtu trade union rep as well, so. And she's an ex-rep, and she's just taken voluntary redundancy from the theatre. The major theatres, which are in Manchester, are owned by a company called ATG. Fucking scum. Sorry for swearing again.
No, you're okay. I didn't know that. I never heard of that company.
Ambassador Theatre Group. Horrible, horrible people. Horrible. But basically, them and the Liverpool Empire Theatre, there's 39 venues outside of the West End they own. They own one Broadway venue, they own a couple in Italy, I believe, and Australia. Where I was made redundant in 2017, I ran away. I was made up, to be honest with you. But I can see that industry going. It's gone. I can't see theatre reopening. I had a message off a friend who's a professional actor. He was in Blood Brothers for a very, very, very long time. And the messages I'm reading, and I'm sorry for anyone out there who thinks I'm a crying artist, I'm not being like that. This, my industry, the creative media industry, create, 3 million jobs. Apparently, Great Britain, the UK is the best at it. You know, we've got so much talent, and I can't go to a pub and play music anymore. So I'm wondering, what's the city centres of Liverpool going to be like? What's the city centre of Manchester, Newcastle, all these great cities which are famous for music? What's going to happen? I can't imagine Matthew Street without hearing any Beatles.
No.
That'll be just...
And you said 3 million people in the industry here in the UK.
Yeah.
That's astonishing. And you know, I don't want to go all arty, because I'm not all arty. I mean, I know an actress very well, a great friend of mine, but I do understand how important to the health of a society the arts is. It's hugely important, isn't it? I mean, you can't overexpress how important a healthy, vibrant art scene is, be it theatre, be it plays, be it musicals, be it singers, musicians like yourself. It's vital to the lifeblood of our, I would say, our mental health, and it's gone.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I mean, if I couldn't play music, I'd probably be insane, but I am insane. But, to me, to not be able to go anywhere, not be able to go and see your favourite band, even if you're into opera, can't go and see your local dramatic operatic society, you can't go and watch professional opera, you can't go and watch ballet, you can't go and watch your mate's band because they're a great up-and-coming band. I mean, I do the fan zone at Man City, right?
Yeah.
And outside the Etihad, and you have that wonderful stage. I mean, it's great what Man City do there, but all them local young, up-and-coming young Manchester bands, where are they going to play? Where are the Scouse bands going to play? Where are the bands coming from down south to come up north because they want to play in Manchester and Liverpool?
It's evil, isn't it? It's evil. This is evil shit, this, isn't it? It's beyond evil.
It's beyond evil. And thanks to you and your hard work and all the stuff you do, mate, and all them people I see on Twitter now and who are tweeting away. And I want a big shout out to the violinist, Mwinga, and the rest of them, Charlie. You know, I feel part of a community. I don't feel alone. I don't feel like I'm going crazy. I can see there's a movement there, but it's trying to get it all organised, like that lady was saying. But I think we do need pitchforks. I do think we need pitchforks and torches and a million of us to hit that fucking Westminster Palace and rip them cunts out of it. Sorry for swearing again. That's how angry it makes me.
Why haven't people stood up to it? You mentioned all of these venues. I mean, you mentioned a particular group, we won't mention them again, they're not here to defend themselves, but there are lots of people who run venues and they're hurting bad as well, Alan. And I say this to people who work in retail, why didn't they tell the government to fuck off? Why didn't they say, no, you're not doing that to us, it'll kill us, we're not going to allow you to kill us, so we're going to say no, we're going to open our venues? Why didn't they stand up to it?
I have no idea. I mean, I personally, I would go and gig I've done a little gig in my garden. I was going to film it, but then like one of my elder neighbours complained, and I thought, you know, I'm going to end up having a 5-0 at my door. I'm not having that. So 5-0, by the way, international people, is Scouse for police.
Right. Used to be the busies. It's replaced the busies.
No, I'm trying not to say busies because, you know, I'm trying to keep up with the kids. They're saying 5-0 now.
It's a different language. The first time I went to Liverpool was donkeys years ago. My schoolboy club went to see Liverpool versus Chelsea. And I didn't want to admit it, but I was really excited. Because when you're a kid, even though I was a diehard United fan, you're excited to be going to watch football in a big stadium anyway. So we went to watch Liverpool versus Chelsea, and we stayed in the city centre. And some of the terminology, it was great crack, like busies, and I hadn't a clue what was being said to me. But no, it's a fantastic city.
Polish, Richie, so I have to do, I'm continuously translating for them.
It's a fantastic place, and until recently, of course, quite often, the oft-mentioned future misses, because it's so close, because it's a lovely place, Liverpool, we've often driven the short journey across to the pool and enjoyed ourselves and had a nice lunch and had a few beers. Before I start taking other calls, don't imagine that it's gone for good, live entertainment and theatre. It can't be, Alan. It can't be.
I'm trying not to think that way, Richie, mate. I'm trying not to, but, you know, I relied on that, my little pub gigs and weddings. You know, I was getting paid well to do that. I was only doing a duo, even though I was running a little soul band for a while. But, you know, me and my mate, we were doing well, and now it's gone. I mean, he's still got his job because he's a mental health professional, but he said it's...
Well, he's going to be in business. He's going to be in business, isn't he?
He works in a secure unit looking after...
Yeah, and they'll be turning them away in their droves. The great Jean Ann Crowley, listening to you, she's fascinated while listening to you, Alan, and she said to me just now, the Greeks built their theatres next to their hospitals. And why? Because they considered theatre to be the hospital of the spirit. It is vital to the lifeblood.
Oh, she's bang on. She's spot on there. I know you've got loads of heads to get on, Richie, so I'm going to go.
Anytime you want to come back, Alan, come back, mate. It's great to put a voice to the name. And thanks for being nice about the programme and getting involved and spreading it around. I really appreciate that. And I do, more than you know.
I want to get weighed in properly again. I'll ping you some more money. Nah.
I hope you're back in business soon, mate. I really mean that. Thanks so much.
I hope everyone.
Cheers, Alan.
Take it easy, Ricky.
Wasn't that lovely to hear from Alan there? And what I'm going to do here now is try and figure out the order, because I have a lot of calls, right, that are lined up. And I've been watching very carefully as people have been trying to get in. And Anthony wanted to call in and sent me a request very, very early on. I think it's Anthony. It might not be Anthony. You get usernames on Skype and on Twitter and you don't know who you're going to be talking to. Let's welcome him. Is it Anthony, by the way?
It is, mate, yeah.
Anthony, welcome to the... I'm so glad I got you on because you were one of the first ones to try to get on today. How are you, my friend? And where are you in the country?
I'm great, mate. It's great to be on the show. Thanks for,
you're a gent.
For
and,
all
and
you do.
Not at all. Where are you today? Where are you based, if you don't mind me asking?
North Lincolnshire.
North Lincolnshire, nice part of the world, it must be said. Well, listen, you're welcome and thanks for connecting with the programme today. You've got the floor and you can basically take the direction you'd like. So go ahead, Anthony, what would you like to say?
It was mainly just to thank you for all you're doing and exposing a lot of the things that's going on. I only sort of found out about your show when the lockdown kicked in. I think I've been interacting with Mark Bierski for a number of years, and I think he must have shared it. So
yeah,
and it came across it from then, and sort of something you said yesterday and the conversation you had today about socialism, it made me realize that I'd not gone crazy, because when I was younger, my sort of political hero used to be the likes of Tony Benn.
Yeah.
And he used to be sort of hardcore Labour, but then all sort of my core beliefs seem to have shifted, if you know what I mean. They no longer seem to be what Labour's all about, and sort of what you would consider to be sort of more left wing, if you like, seems to have gone over to the other side, but sort of been anti-EU and stuff like that.
So you find yourself like Alan from South London earlier on. People start accusing you of being a conservative because of opinions that were standard beliefs for socialists and trade unionists, right?
Yeah, definitely. But a bit like the lady was saying as well, the first caller, I think the
Louise, yeah.
The time of duality, the sort of left and right, I think that needs to come to an end now. It needs to be, it's maybe a little bit woo-woo, but it needs to be sort of more heart-based approach to it than sort of the egocentric way things have been run. And one thing I wanted to ask, I know there appears to be like lots of chaos and everything, and when you're thinking about it all in your head, it seems like everything is going a little bit to shit. But yeah. Do you also have a feeling, sort of more in your heart maybe, that things are changing? Like there seems to be more and more people waking up to what's going on and stuff like that. I just wondered what you thought of that.
Kind of on a daily basis, it kind of changes. I've had some bad days of late, you know, where I've thought that we're basically screwed. But then, Anthony, you come across people doing really nice things for people. You mentioned Mark Bajerski. Mark is one of a few people whom I know who spends a lot of time doing very benevolent things, you know, at quite often at a cost to himself. And that gives me a bit of a boost. And I think, well, there are a lot of really nice people out there. And I think you're right. A lot of people, maybe because of the lockdown, are maybe beginning to see things they hadn't seen before. So it's kind of a day-by-day basis. I change my mind as often as I change my undergarments, as it were, Anthony, you know. But you sound yourself like you're optimistic. You think that the glass is maybe more half full than half empty.
Yeah, it's a little bit like that. A bit the same as you. I have good days and bad days. I mean, you see some things like what's going on in Leicester, and you just can't wrap your head around how people are just accepting it. I mean, they even had the mayor on who said the reason they've got more positive tests is because they've tested more people than anywhere else. And it's... you see people accepting that, but then you'll see something else where people are just saying that it's complete nonsense, or people are helping people out who are struggling and things like that. I think it's a little bit of a mix.
How has it affected you, Anthony? If you don't mind me asking, you don't have to answer this, of course, but when this all began, what has it meant for you personally, this lockdown?
It's been... the biggest concern for me has been the effect it's having on my daughter, because obviously her school closed. My partner's, she's a teacher, so she was on furlough. I worked for a family business. I was furloughed. We've been affected a bit financially, but obviously we're a lot luckier than some people. But it's been more trying to shield my daughter from it and not getting into any of this nonsense, not being afraid of people and stuff like that.
Right.
I don't want to get into any of that. So it's, yeah.
That's really interesting. It's really interesting you saying that, Anthony, because we've obviously heard many of us who look at things with a different perspective. We know people in our neighbourhoods and we do listen to them and we do look at their experiences. And one of my neighbours has told me that his daughter is scared of people and is terrified of catching a bug and then maybe giving it to granny and killing granny. And that's a dreadful thing, that. And it's very interesting you saying that you've taken measures to try and avoid your daughter, you know, hearing that sort of thing. It can't be easy, that.
It is difficult, but I've sort of said from day one, I was like, look, it's me and my partner who decide who comes in the house. It's not the government who tells us. It's us who decide who we go see and who we can hug and who we can shake hands with and things like that. It's our decision. So I've been trying to instill that into her a little bit, as much as I can.
And not having children ourselves, I just wouldn't know, you know, what it's like. I'm going to jump into some more calls, Anthony. Let me first of all thank you for finding the programme. I really appreciate that you do listen and that you called in today. And thanks to Mark Bajerski for introducing you to it. Terrific bloke, Mark. Can't speak highly enough about him and what he does for people. And I hope you'll stay in touch with us, Anthony. And I wish you all the very best, mate. I really do.
Yeah, definitely. I'll stay in touch, mate. And if you're looking for an interesting guest who's got a different sort of slant on Trump and what's going on with all this COVID thing, there's a guy called Charles Ward on YouTube. I don't know if you've seen him, but I think he would make a good guest on the show one day.
Let me just make a note of it there. I haven't actually come across Charles, no, but I'll get straight on to it, because you're always looking, when you do shows like this, you're always looking to bring on brand new people that you've never heard from before. So I'll check him out, Anthony. That's a promise, and we'll extend an invite to him. Thanks, mate, for coming on. I really enjoyed meeting you.
Yeah, all the best, mate.
Cheers, Anthony. That was Anthony there in North Lincolnshire. I'm pretty sure he said North Lincolnshire. We're off to Florida now, believe it or not. We're off to Florida. And a pal of mine who is very good in terms of sending me information that I can use during the programme. And he's been involved in the anti-war movement and peace activism in Florida and on the east coast of the United States for many, many years. And he's a great connector of people. He's a great connector of people, connecting journalists with activists. And he came on this programme about 3 years ago. And he was brilliant on the programme. He should have been back since then. But he's busy in his own job. Let's welcome back to the show Phil Restino, my accountant friend in Florida. Hey, Phil, welcome back. How are you?
Hi, Richie. Can you hear me okay?
You sound brilliant. You sound like you're in the next room.
Thank you. I'm glad you're allowing for calls in. The show's always good. Calls or no calls, I try never to miss the show. But I'm here in Florida, and we've got the July 4th Independence Day weekend, which is the number one weekend out of the whole year where people go to the beach and barbecue. And you mentioned earlier in the show, they lock down the beaches. They're not letting people go to the beach.
Incredible.
You know, the fresh air, the wind, the water, the sea. It's I feel like screaming, Richie, with this lockdown and the masks and the... It's only getting worse over here, it seems.
Imagine the irony, Phil. Independence Day weekend.
Yes.
But you can't go to the beaches because you might get a virus from somebody. It's insane.
Yeah. And
isn't it?
I think they had people actually wearing face masks on the beach at some point, I saw. And
yeah.
It's how do we fight this? You know, we have a governor, God bless him, that doesn't want to close the state down. But what's happening is the different counties, they're making these mandates county by county. And our county started last week, and I'll be damned, I'm not wearing one of these masks. And I guess I'll handle it if I'm ever called on it, you know.
Too right, Phil. Hey, listen, you're educating our listeners now, right now. This is important. So your governor wants to keep the state open because obviously businesses need to survive. But the individual counties in Florida, they retain the right to basically overrule the governor. Is that right? Each individual county can make its own mind.
Yes.
Ah.
That's correct. And as well as cities and towns. And there's a group here in Central Florida called Reopen Florida, and it's on the Facebook somewhere. I'm in touch with a few of them, and what they've done is they've gone to different counties and the commissions and spoken out against the upcoming lockdowns and mandated face mask wearing. And I don't know if they have any wins yet, but there is a handful of people fighting. I think initially they politicized the people that spoke up against the lockdown and the masks a few months ago. And I don't know if it was infiltrated or what, but they made it political. They had the Donald Trump supporters going to these rallies and waving the Trump flag. So immediately anyone on the left dug in their heels.
Yeah.
And labeled anyone who's against the lockdown and wearing masks as right-wing Republicans.
I tried to touch on this in the monologue, but I made, as we say in Ireland, I made a balls of it. What I was trying to say was, you just outlined it there, rather than attack the lockdown for its stupidity and its harm, which the left would have done traditionally, they would prefer to attack the right-wing leader, whether it's Trump or whether it's Boris Johnson, by claiming that he's not done enough lockdown and that, in fact, he's harming people. This is what a strange paradigm we exist in, Phil, eh? These are crazy.
It is. This political party, and I've experienced it with the anti-war movement, you know, boy, impeach Junior Bush for the wars of aggression. But once the Democrat came in, all that dropped, you know. And our little chapter here in Central Florida, we held to the impeaching Obama cause, but we took a lot of hell for it, and we got no support from the left because everything, so many people's identity is one team or the other. But that's what we're dealing with, Richie. But the thing is right now is, okay, they're not going to help us. What are we going to do? And I can't say enough for the trifold handbills, leaflets, pamphlets.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they're one of the best means of informing our fellows. I want to get one made for this coronavirus and the mask, and I'm going to reach out to the fella on the high wire with Dell Bigtree. He's got a program like your own. And I know folks, I'm always suggesting guests, and you're doing whatever you can just to have a show every day. But I would like to suggest this fellow, Dell Bigtree, the high wire with Dell Bigtree. He's involved with Dr. Wakefield and all that.
Yeah,
with
Vax. Yeah. I saw the film. Yeah, I saw the film Vax. It's an interesting thing. He was invited to come on when Vax came out and he declined. And it was because at the time, it was because there was someone savoury. Have we lost Phil? Are you there, Phil?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
We lost you momentarily. Yeah, listen, Bigtree was invited on with me in the past and declined. And then his people came back when the second Vaxxed film was ready. And they said, oh, he'd like to come on now. And I could have been childish if I wanted to and said, well, he's not coming on. But I didn't. I said, no problem. And then they decided not to come on the second time. So I don't care too much about Dell Bigtree, as it happens right now. But I appreciate what he's doing. There's a lot of diva behaviour in the independent media. Look, enough of that. Anyway, what about the fear porn in your media, Phil? I mean, we think it's bad here, but it must be bad there, right?
It is so bad. And it's almost like the corporate media, it's almost like they have a gleam in their eye. Telling people to put their masks and celebrate. It's like they're celebrating a police state. You know, they're not journalists. And thank God for the independent citizen journalists that have just stepped up to the cause, whatever the cause is, and gotten on the internet and become active. I really believe, Richie, we're the answer we've been waiting for.
I hope you're right,
Everyone
Phil.
Can do something.
I hope you're right. I want to endorse what you said about citizen journalism. Because if it wasn't for people with camera phones, we wouldn't have learned about all of the empty hospitals all over the US and all over England when they were telling us that they were bursting to capacity. And of course, while they were telling us this, we were seeing nurses doing the can-can and putting on theatrical productions so that they could get themselves on Twitter. So citizen journalism, absolutely brilliant. I want to ask you this before, first of all, I want to get you back on as a proper guest very soon, right? So we'll organise that. But before I move on to another call, I learned yesterday, I didn't bring it up on the show last night, I forgot all about it, but I learned that the University of Tennessee, and I think you'll probably know this, has announced that returning students in the fall or the autumn will have to be immunised against the flu or they won't be allowed into classes. And if there is a COVID-19 vaccine, they must take that as well. Otherwise, no entry to Tennessee University. So you say we are the answer we've been waiting for, and I think you're right, I hope you're right. I would say we are now where we thought we would end up. When the universities basically say, you've got to have a vaccine or you can't come to classes. What's going on, Phil?
Yes, and that's been reported on by a number of people. You may have had them on your show in the past. I believe you've had Jason Burmis.
Jason has been on. He's all over this story. That's right. That's where I heard it, actually. I heard it from Jason and from Spiro. Spiro's been covering
Spiro
it as well. Yeah.
And the other fellow, the last American vagabond, Christian is his last name. I'm drawing a blank. They're on it. But I tell you that the American people, they roll over so easily. And I saw that with 9/11, just roll over and almost celebrate the lie and the police state and the loss of liberty.
What was it like, Phil? What was it like to be you when the Patriot Act passed and you knew what it was because you are you, you're Phil Restino, you've got a brain. Yes. And yet you were surrounded by your friends and family and neighbours who blissfully went about their business as if it was no big thing. And yet you knew it was. That must have been a crazy time for you.
It sure is. And it still hurts to this day, Richie. When I first saw one of the 9/11 truth DVDs and it woke me up to 9/11, my reaction was anger. And I was angry not just the bastards that did it, but at myself for being fooled. And I thought I had to show my family and friends. We had to show people. And I thought they would get angry too, but they got angry at me. You know, the American people don't want to hear it. And I think we just, as I've learned from other activists, they said, Phil, don't waste your time on the ones that don't want to hear it. Just keep getting out there. And I can't say enough for these trifold pamphlets where you take a piece of paper and you print double-sided and you fold it in threes and you put it on people's windshields. You put them in the, you get junk mail and it has a postage paid return envelope. You stick one in there, throw it back in the mailbox. I have a bunch of them on the front seat of my car, the Firefighters for 9/11 Truth. Every time I see a vehicle that has a firefighter emblem on it, I stick it on the windshield. Same thing with the USS Liberty. If I see a vehicle with a veteran sticker on it, I put it on the windshield. And I'm going to work on trying to contact people, see if we can get one of these flyers made to fight back against this coronavirus lockdown. And once I have one, Richie, I'll forward it to you.
Do, Phil.
And
do, mate.
Yes.
Listen, I'm going to take another few calls before I run out of time. Come back on and do a segment with me real soon, Phil, because when you came on the first time, the response to it was huge. People loved having you on. You've got a lot of friends in the independent media and beyond, and I know you know that, so do, mate. Sad state of affairs in Florida this Independence Day weekend, but you're there doing your bit, and I appreciate you for it. Thanks for coming on today, Phil.
Thank you so much, Richie.
Love you, pal. You're a top man. Top man, Phil Restino. Huge help to people like me and Spiro and many others, sending us information, newspaper articles, bits and pieces that often turn into radio shows. He's a great guy. I'm going to the phones again because a caller has been trying to get in with great patience for some time. Before I take the caller on, let me give you a time check. 27 minutes past six. It is Wednesday's programme, July 1st, 2020. Give you a heads up, Mark Collett, the author and conservative commentator, will be on the programme with me tomorrow. He'll be among the guests. I will have a couple of guests tomorrow, Thursday. And there's still time between now and the top of the hour. If you want to come on and talk with me today, the Skype name is Chat with Richie. That's Chat with Richie. And the, say it for me, the phone number is 0161 418 2018. Back to the phone. Caller, welcome to the programme. How are you?
Good, Richie. How you doing?
Not too bad. Who am I speaking with?
Aid in Watford.
How you doing, Aid? Welcome back.
How you doing? You're right.
Yeah, good. I don't save numbers when people phone in and put names with numbers. Otherwise, I would have known it was you. Aid, you've got the floor, my friend. I am going to move it along fairly swiftly because I've got a few more calls I want to get on. But good to talk to you again, my friend. It's over to you.
Okay. Just a quick one. I know there were some issues around security and all the rest of it, but I just wanted to mention again, gently encourage you, if you can, for those of us who don't want to use PayPal.
Let me tell you why. Let me interrupt you.
Go on.
And I said this before. I am not a member of the Truth or Industrial Complex. I don't tell lies to solicit donations or to solicit web traffic. My life was threatened last year and the wife of my partner, and it was very serious. Very serious. It was a credible threat because of some of the things I've been saying about the state of Israel. And I know that if somebody really wanted to find out where I live, they could do so. but I want to make it very difficult. And I could get a P.O. box reasonably close to where I live, but I'm very reluctant to do so at the moment. And I love you for wanting to support the programme, and I totally understand why people don't want to deal with PayPal or the banks, but I've got to have some tiny semblance of security around about what I do. I'd love to have an address where people could send postal orders or money orders or whatever, and I'd love to be able to do that and sleep easy, Aid. But I, at the moment, I can't see how I can do that without putting myself at risk.
Fair enough, mate. Maybe one day I can pop up to Manchester. We can go for a beer, and then I can...
There you are, and I'll buy you a beer back, and it won't matter anyway. No, no, I appreciate that.
Maybe that's a solution. But I imagine there are loads of people who... listen, I totally get it. It's personal security. You got to think of you and your missus first. That's fine. Anyone would understand that.
There's a reason why I go everywhere with a big and fairly grumpy 12-year-old German Shepherd dog. What was the old gangster saying? You get further with a kind word and a gun than just a kind word. I get further with a kind word and a German Shepherd than just a kind word. Listen, I'm not in fear of my life. I don't believe that anybody's going to kill me. But at the same time, because I'm not important, I'm not any threat to the establishment or to the elite. But there are people who don't like certain people because of the things they say, and it makes them very angry. And there are Zionist lobbyists in this country who don't like me. And that's the way it bloody well is. Listen, on what's going on, I'm sure you've got a couple of things you'd like to say anyway.
Okay. All right. Okay, so I've just obviously been listening to the calls and stuff like that. And obviously, you know, why do people acquiesce? And obviously, it goes without saying, whatever this is, however they've structured it and facilitated it, it's a fantastic propaganda job. Right, there's no two ways about it. It was instant, it was global, and it's ongoing, and it's relentless. And I imagine to the average guy in the street, you know, there might be a lot of, you know, I'm not going to swear because you swear, but there might be a load of nonsense going on in terms of the narrative that they're projecting. But it's not going to be all rubbish. There's going to be certain elements of truth. And I think that's what keeps people sort of locked down in fear, you know, scared shitless, because when it's all said and done, you know, statistically, yeah, you know, it's no worse in terms of fatalities in terms of a normal flu season.
Yeah.
Right. But obviously, because it's more nuanced than that, and it's obviously relentless 24 hours a day. You know, I imagine, I mean, me, I can't talk for other people. You know, my general opinion is clearly there's something massive going on. And basically, this is why I say it. What is it that they're trying to distract us away from? That's what I come back to. This is, on the basis of the statistics, it would appear this is just, you know, propaganda overload. But the question is, what is it that they don't want us to focus on? You know, whoever they are, you know, whether it's a finance, you know, there's talk of a massive financial crash where, you know, we've got various theatres of war going on all over the planet, blah, 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 blah. And that's what I come back to, I think, you know, because obviously, you know, the testing side of things, right? Obviously, David Icke sort of mentions, well, you know, they're testing, but what are they testing for? Have they isolated the virus, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
And they haven't, have they, Aid? This is a very important point you're bringing up. As far as I understand, and I've looked into this today because I knew this might come up, they haven't isolated this bloody thing. When they're testing, they're getting positive hits for any number of viral strains, right? As far as I understand.
Yeah. That's how I... Sorry, go on.
No. Is that how you see it?
That's how I understand it. But my thinking is, you know, if you think, you know, sort of mass propaganda stroke conspiracy, you know, my attitude, my thinking is most doctors and people in the medical profession do their job in good faith, right? They do their job in good faith.
Yeah.
Most of these people in white coats, right, they're not beyond messing things up and lying, but most of them, I imagine, do it for the right reasons. And so I come back to, well, surely we know what's going on, right? So Mr. Coleman and this and that and all these other people, all of these medical people are standing up saying, no, this is completely bollocks, this is rubbish, but they're not getting anywhere near ITV, BBC One, any of the Sky, whatever. And if they do, they're on and they're rubbished straight away. But you sort of think to yourself, well, surely the people in white coats who know what they're talking about have identified and surely looked at it and gone, well, hang on a minute, this testing is complete nonsense. Because, again, if I'm not a medical person, but this thing I get stuck on, if they haven't isolated the virus, then how can they manufacture a test for it? It's nonsense.
Yeah, it's nonsense. And this is the $64,000 question. Where are the men and women in the laboratory coats who must be seeing this, who must be saying to themselves, what is going on? This is nonsense. Where are they? And the only answer I can give, and I certainly don't know the answer, but the only suggestion I could make is probably two or three fold. One, nervous about what it might mean for their job security if they start asking questions, you know. Mm. Two, compartmentalization. Maybe they're not part of the tests, or maybe they're not doing the work and are being told from people above them, listen, we've done the research, we've done the work, here's the answer. I don't know. I reckon it's probably a combination of things. But you make a very good point about Vernon Coleman. Here's the guy who wrote for the National Press for years. He's a very well-known and well-liked doctor. He's written best-selling books. He's worked as a GP, unblemished. And he is saying loud and clear to hundreds of thousands of people on social media, this is wrong. And you would have imagined, you said it yourself, ITV, Sky, BBC, you would imagine that they would be killing themselves to get to his front door to say... Right, but no.
It's because obviously the thing that really puts it terrifies me is this is it basically. We've had COVID viruses are not, you know, this might be, I'm not sure whether it's, because I know you've hinted, oh, it might be manufactured. I'm sort of in two minds about that. I'm not sure. But anyway, let's look at history. We COVID virus or whatever they class it as, but, you know, we've had swine flu and this flu and pigs may fly flu and all the rest of it and blah, blah, blah. So, and Ebola. So they've had experience of protocols that they enact when they come across something they call a coronavirus. So it's not like they had no idea what they were dealing with. It might be unique, a new virus, but the protocols would have been more or less the same. But they were discharging people from hospital and putting them straight into old people's homes.
That was sick. And they were saying,
they must have known. I'm sorry. When it winds me up, it drives me more than that. When they go, oh, it was a mistake. And I'm sorry. No. This isn't a mistake. At the very least, this is manslaughter.
That's what Vernon Coleman says. Yeah, Vernon Coleman says they knew when they said they needed to free up the beds in the hospitals, so they needed to send the geriatrics out of the hospitals and into care homes. He's convinced that they knew what the consequences would be, because you've got people in care homes, their health is compromised, they're older people, they're run down. The last thing in the world they need, it's like a bloody grenade being thrown into the place. You're bang on.
And it's in the, go on. See, it's just in the context of, remember, the protocols around dealing with a quote-unquote coronavirus would have been there in black and white for going back through the relatively recent history. So that's where I focus on that. I go, well, hang on, if it was Ebola, if they were diagnosed with Ebola, they wouldn't be sending them back to the fucking care home, right?
Yeah, they wouldn't.
Coronavirus.
Yeah.
Why are you sending them back? And that's the thing. I look at that and I go, that's proper psychopathic.
Well,
you can't claim it was a mistake. I'm sorry, I don't care.
Tell you what we'll do, because I believe Dean Smith is trying to get through. Now, Dean, Dean has been on with me, but it's a long, long time. Dean has run and does run a care home. Yeah. So I'm going to get him on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember listening to
Yeah,
song.
Because he's obviously got something to say about this. Ed, thanks for coming on, mate. Good to hear
Next
from you.
Next time I'm in Manchester.
We'll have a pint, mate. If we can get into a bar without wearing a bloody gimp suit, that was Ed there in Watford. Nice to hear from Ed again. Now, Dean Smith is a friend of the programmes. He's not spoken on the phone in for a long time. And, of course, he knows all about care homes. Let's get Dean on. It's 21 minutes to the top of the hour. This is the Richie Allen Radio Show, the global phone-in. I love these phone-ins. Nice to be doing them. Good to be hearing from you. We'll give Dean a minute to get ready there. I did tell him a few minutes and then I rang him immediately. That's the sort of thing I do. We'll speak in a few minutes and then I rang him straight away. Dean, are you there?
Hello, yes, mate.
It's good to have you back on, mate. It's been ages.
It's been a while.
It's been a while, and no better man to talk to about what the policy of sending senior citizens out of hospitals into care homes, what that policy would have meant for people in care homes around the country. Over to you. What do you think?
Well, to be honest, mate, it didn't really affect me so much because my care home's a LD unit. So I do have elderly, but it's a real mixed bunch. So
yeah, I've been following you on Twitter. I know that it didn't affect you personally, but working with elderly people and people with obviously underlying conditions, you would have known, just from you being you, what it would have meant for other care homes around the country. It was obviously a crazy thing to do.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, they were releasing people with the suspected virus, getting people back into the care homes, which clearly was a massive high risk for the people that were living there anyway, and for the staff. So with the elderly, it was huge. It was a massive problem, which has been, you know, clearly highlighted throughout the media, the mainstream media, let alone the other media. But yeah, it was a massive problem for a lot of care homes. Not so much in my area. I mean, we've been quite lucky where my care home is, which is it's in Grimsby. I live in Sheffield, but it's in Grimsby. So the North East Links area has fared pretty well, to be honest. So it's difficult to say from that sort of from the angle of some care homes. I think it's my one of my nieces that worked in a care home in Sheffield lost 18 residents within a 2-week space.
18 people died in the 18. Care home she worked. My God.
Yeah. Yeah, because basically, as you well know, doctors have not been attending. People have not been getting their routine appointments. I know in certain areas as well, they've had medication supply shortages and stuff like that. So it's been really tough for a lot of the care homes. But still, would this outbreak have been any worse with the flu? You know, these are the questions that everybody's sort of posing, you know.
Before you take over again, before you came to say what you came on to say, I'm reminded of Hayden Hewitt's mother-in-law, who was in a care home, and I just want to endorse what you said there about doctors not coming out, and she's passed on now, rest in peace, the lady. Yeah, but Hayden told me a few weeks back, and there was a lot of interest in it because I know the mayor of Manchester, Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, got involved. But the doctor didn't want to come out, basically, and were prepared to diagnose COVID over the phone, basically. I mean, it was crazy. And you've told me that 18 in one care home, and this was at the direct policy of sending people with the virus, whatever it is, into these care homes. Vernon Coleman says it's basically extermination. Massive scandal. Sorry, Dean, I cut across to you anyway. I just wanted to say that. Go ahead.
No, that's fine. It's been a weird situation in the. I wanted to mainly talk about the sort of testing procedure, because obviously we're sort of doing that firsthand, and I link the amount, like a lot of people have done mathematically, the numbers don't stack up, the data doesn't stack up. You can fudge the data, but you can't fudge the mathematics. And I just think the amount of testing and the pressure that's been put on us to do the tests and to test the clients that I look after, despite them not having real capacity to be able to consent to the tests in the first place. But every week I'm getting sort of emails from the NHS CCG, which is the Clinical Commissioning Group, and the CQC have been involved, but then there's like a critical care team that call every single day to, it's almost like they're desperate to get people to test positive. And so far I've only been able to test three of mine because the others have sort of refused despite being non-communicative, and having complex needs. It's quite clear to see that they don't want something shoving down the throat and up their nose.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've took that on board and tested the three that were willing to do it and had capacity. Now, out of those three tests that I've done, two came back unclear, one was lost. Now, how they lost one, I don't know, when they all went back together. I've managed to test three staff. A lot of my staff are reluctant to do it. But the three staff members have come back negative, and a lot of the others don't want to do it for various reasons. And I would kind of support that until it becomes mandatory. But that's a concern in the future that will become the case, you know, that
they might mandate it. Before you talk about that, you said something a few seconds ago. It's important to return to it. You said they can fudge the tests, but they can't fudge the mathematics. Why do you believe that it's easy to fudge the testing, to mess it up, to get the wrong results?
Well, I believe the whole thing, as a lot of people do, is a complete plandemic. It's clearly something, and that makes it really difficult for me to work in the role I work with, when I do believe that it's a massive scam. So that's why I think they're doing it, because clearly the more tests they do, even if the test is 80% successful or not, you're still going to get so many false positives. So the more they roll out, even when I signed up for because you have to sign up, every single test is logged, monitored, and then the CQC get an email, the CCG get an email. I have to do a capacity tracker every single day to give them updates on COVID numbers and who's been tested, who's not been tested, who's positive, who's not, what about the staff? You know, so many things I have to do on a daily basis. And it's just, it's so frustrating, because I just genuinely believe they're pushing it so, so much and so hard to be able to get these numbers up.
And by doing that, it gives them the green light then to enforce localised lockdowns and do what they've done in Leicester. And UK media is reporting today that 36 more areas can expect to be told to lock down again.
I saw that today as well, yeah.
And you're operating a care home there. It's just, you say to people?
I was going to say, so many people within the unit, everybody, so far, everybody's healthy. Nobody's had any symptoms. Nobody's had any coughs or colds or temperatures. We would check temperatures if anyone was poorly, you know, I'd be a lot more concerned.
Yeah.
But I've just been sort of making sure they have a vitamin C and zinc drink every day, keeping hopefully keeping their immune systems topped up, as I would do for myself.
So you're making sure they get vitamin C and zinc. Do you imagine that in state-run care homes or other care homes, do you imagine that anybody is making sure that vitamin C or vitamin D or zinc is on the menu for people who need it? I'm going to say I'm skeptical that it's going on elsewhere. What do you think?
How could I possibly know that, Richard?
I know. I'm asking you to speculate.
It depends on the RM themselves. If they are clued up and they look at alternative ways of healing. You know, I've always been an advocate for trying to get people off medication, not getting people onto it.
But you know what, Dean? Do you know what? It why wouldn't places that care for the elderly and, you know, those who are in care, you know, who are going to be spending the rest of their days in care, why wouldn't those places make sure they get vitamin C, vitamin D and zinc? It's common sense, right?
It's
you would have thought. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, the mind boggles. It's nuts. If you don't do your own research and you do sing from the song sheets like the like the GPs. I'm a professional in the sense I'm an RM, but I'm no medical professional. But I've had many arguments with many a GP over the wrongly prescribed medical or certain things they want to prescribe, and I didn't think it was right. And it's only because I've had so many years experience that I've got the confidence to be able to sort of do that. But I would imagine there's a lot of managers out there that perhaps wouldn't challenge it. I don't know. That'd be impossible for me to call completely.
I'm going to try and get one or two more calls in. I might do something on this in a couple of weeks' time, not as a phone-in, but do a show on it. If I do, and I think I will do, I'll give you a heads-up, Dean. We'll get you on. I might get a panel going on this, because it's very important. It's massively important. Caring for the elderly.
Could I just give a quick mention out as well, Richie?
To anybody, go ahead.
It's just on a weekend, I've been attending the stand-up sort of protests, so I've been able to try and get my voice out. I know Piers Morgan does the London one.
Piers Corbyn you're thinking of.
Piers Corbyn, sorry.
Piers
Corbyn does the stand-up ex London, and I've been doing the one Sheffield, and there's ones very... So if people look stand-up for the stand-up movement, grassroots movement, to try and just give people information about how much the numbers have been bent and how much we think this is a complete hoax. So it goes against everything I should do professionally, to be honest. But I just feel so strongly about it that I'm out there on the streets. And even last time I wrote, instead of sort of, I'm stood in the streets with a megaphone reading poetry about the bloody coronavirus and whatever else, because...
Yeah, you've got some talent as a poet, to be honest, as a bard, it must be said. You do.
If people want to, I've done a few over the COVID one recently, Rich, but I know you've probably not got time to hear it, but I was stood in the street with a megaphone reading it. And instead of shouting at people, I thought a bit of art might help to get the message across. But if people want to get involved or engage with the stand-up movement, I think that'd be really good, because it's just peace-loving people wanting to question the numbers and the you know, how they've been falsifying COVID on death certificates and all that sort of stuff. There are good people out there trying to spread the word, sort of thing. And people are listening now more than ever.
Brilliant, Dean. Brilliant for you to come back on, mate. We'll catch up again real soon. I'd like to do a show on how this has affected people, senior citizens in particular, but care for senior citizens and end-of-life care. I'd like to do a show on that, and I'd like you to be part of it.
Sure.
For sure.
No problem.
Thanks, mate. And thanks for doing that with Piers Corbyn and others as well. I really appreciate it. And I know a lot of our listeners do as well. Cheers,
Dean. Great stuff, mate. Thanks for having me on, Rich.
Anytime. Look after yourself. Great. A very timely call there from Dean, who operates a care home, which isn't far from Sheffield, as far as I understand it. It's 9 minutes to the top of the hour. I know that Natalie was trying to get on. We better be quick with calls. A lot of calls still trying to get in, and I'm trying to get them on in order. I'm going to do more of these, by the way. I get criticised for not doing too many of them. I am going to do more of them. I'm going to enshrine them in the schedule, one every 2 weeks from here on in, because we end up with probably a dozen or two dozen people who've tried to get on the programme and don't get on. So we will do more of them. And we'll give over more time to them, because I really do enjoy listening to people phoning in. It's a great surprise to me, people calling in from different parts of the country, from overseas. I really appreciate it. Somebody making a point on Twitter that we haven't had too many calls today from ladies. We had Louise at the very beginning. Ordinarily, we do get a lot of female callers. Today, it's been predominantly blokes calling in. I don't know why that is. I suppose it's the look of the draw, I suppose. I don't have a producer here. We can't screen the calls. We can't enforce positive discrimination. I can't say to my producer, hey, listen, filter out the female callers, even if I wanted to do that. So it is the way it is, I suppose. Let me give you a reminder that I will be joined tomorrow by Mark Collett, that's right, the author and conservative commentator. David Vance, who's been on this programme several times. You know David. Controversial figure, although he doesn't mind. Doesn't bother him. He's how would I call him? He's a unionist, as in a loyalist. Northern Ireland, David. Conservative commentator. Done a lot of work on the BBC. Defunding the BBC and stuff like that. He's been trying to get Katie Hopkins on this programme. I don't know if it's going to happen. She's welcome to come on the programme, of course, and talk about free speech and censorship and the right and conservatism, if she wants to. But he's been trying to organise that because he's a personal friend of hers. We'll see how it goes. Natalie is a friend of ours and these days is presenting a live metal programme for TriggerWarning.tv, which follows this programme on Tuesday evenings. And it's going great guns. So it is. Natalie, welcome back. How are you?
Hi, Richie.
Good to be chatting with you again.
Great. How are you, man?
I'm great. It seems like ages since we hooked up at the Meatspace thing in Manchester when it was great to make your acquaintance. Congratulations on doing the metal show on Trigger Warning. Love a bit of
Thank
that.
Thank you very much.
And you're a musician, of course, an accomplished musician as well.
No. I mean, I think I'm replacing my what I should be with this radio show, to be honest, which is why I haven't given up. You know, at least music is still in my life, you know.
Thank God, eh? What a depressing call from Alan earlier on, Bass Ninja. Lovely, because he's lovely fella. He's very upbeat, very positive. But the effect this is having on live music, and listen, you've recently been involved in pubs yourself, so I suppose you know all about it. Hey, listen, I'll shut up because we've got about 4 minutes. You say what you wanted to say, and thanks for phoning up.
No, that's cool, man. I'm happy to chat with you as always. I'm one of the few in my company that was not furloughed, and we are now operating at 100%, but with only 20% like support behind that. I want the furlough bullshit to end to bring them back. Just for a purely selfish reason, but that's my bottom line right now. We're now in the seventh month of the year, and obviously the company I work for, they owe me, you know, was it four or five weeks of holiday between my small team when they do come back. You know, basically there's always going to be at least two or three people off from now until the end of the year.
Yeah.
So I just kind of wanted to give that. Not really interesting, but that extra perspective in that when people do return from work, or sorry, from furlough to work, we still have, you know, only now like 5 or 6 months left of the year for everyone to take their holiday. And it's a real big strain. I've been told that I have work from home privilege, which is insane. It's probably more insane than the whole, you know, the white privilege thing that's thrown in our faces, man. And I just wanted to put that perspective online because no one's hearing it, you know.
Nobody is hearing it. What sort of a strain is that going to place on businesses generally? You know, when so they're being told, you can open up now so long as you can provide social distancing at work. But they're going to be burdened. Listen, I'm a trade unionist and I'm a workers' rights guy first and foremost, but you've got to be mature and you've got to think about the people who run the companies. They're going to be in all sorts of financial difficulties, aren't they, Natalie, when they come back? Huge.
But I work in retail IT, and the company that I work for, they're global.
Right.
US and the EU, they haven't really hit the Asian market and for whatever reason, it's fine. We are now operating at 100%, almost 100%, minus the riots in the US and trashing a lot of our stores for whatever reason. We're operating at 100%. What I'm saying is that we can't operate those from the background with only 15% of people supporting them. I want furlough to end, and it's exactly the same in the stores. They're bless them. The people out there, you're talking about frontline, that word you hate. We're talking retail. Of course, before COVID, they were working 10, 11, 12 hours, whatever. But now they're running at less than 50% because they're retail staff. They're deemed, less important.
Yeah.
But they still have an active role to play. And they're running at less than 50%. Every single high street shop that you can go in now, you know, you might have a complaint about a dress or a T-shirt or something. There's no one there because they're all busy. There's someone assigned to the door. There's someone assigned to the escalators. There's somebody assigned to the first steps up to the next floor, that kind of thing. It's crazy, man. And everywhere already has, I call them spit bars because that sounds a bit more metal, but they're sneeze guards. Everywhere is like a fucking when you walk into the bathroom and it's all cordoned off. You know that's what retail looks like right now. It's crazy.
Yeah, and I'm a mile, I suppose, and a half from Manchester city centre, but I've not gone anywhere near the city in months. I dread seeing what you've described there. I just don't want to experience that, to be honest. I mean,
it might be good as just an observational, you know, exercise perhaps.
But it boils your blood, and I might give the impression of being a fairly, you know, affable chap on this programme, but, and I'm not saying that I'm fake when I'm on the show. I'm not fake. I am myself, but I've got no patience for that, to be honest. I don't.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. It's difficult to serve them or to support them. It's been interesting. I think the retail companies, while we're talking about retail and stuff, those that did do well online before COVID, they're still holding up. But the ones that didn't invest that time, not necessarily money or resource, but that time into like developing stuff online, they're the ones that are failing now. The retail itself, the retail high street, if they invested in both, yeah, they'll be okay. But if they didn't, then their high street end is going to die, and then, you know, the company on its own is going to.
And I suppose we'll see what happens. I suppose you and I might share the same, not the same opinion, but perspective. I believe that this thing, whatever is happening, this, I call it tyranny. It's multifaceted in terms of it's meant to do lots of different things, bring in cashless society, bring in mandatory vaccinations, bring in more surveillance. But I also believe that it is meant to destroy businesses on behalf of the massive companies like Google and Amazon. I believe that's self-evident. Maybe you disagree. I don't know. What do you think?
No, not in the slightest. I don't disagree at all. But then where is that gap?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you're talking about Amazon, Google, Apple, Intel, etc. They're always going to be fine. They're always going to be fine. But I mean, does that mean that basically that line is there and everything on the high street dies? Does Boots go online? Do Superdrug go online? Do like Holland and Barrett? You know, they you know.
Is the answer yes, Natalie? For you, is the answer yes? It's inevitable. I think it's inevitable. I hate to be pessimistic. I think it's inevitable. I think the high streets are going to become unbearable for people. I mean, they'll do it lots of different ways. One of the ways they're doing it is making it impossible for anybody to drive anywhere near these places. You just can't, right? Number one. Number two, business rates have crippled the high street anyway. Look at the state of our high streets now. You walk down them and every second shop is some wretched charity shop.
Yeah, and I know, it's even worse than that, man. I mean, every other shop, like you said, every second shop is not just a charity. Every other shop on top of that is just closed, man.
Just closed, yeah, gone, yeah.
And it has been for a long time. It's pre-COVID, it's like the high street, like I'm doing the air quotation marks, the high street has been dying for like, I don't know, Mark Windows, bless him, he can correct me on this, like 15, 20 years, depending on where you're going.
No, you're right, you are right. You go back as far as that, that's when it began. Definitely.
Yeah, for real. You know, the smaller places bought up by the bigger places, but those bigger places now are being effed in the A. Sorry. So I don't see any way of normality. I mean, we've not even spoken about, you know, my hospitality experience, and we're touching 7 o'clock now. But yeah, I would not like to be running a pub right now. I'm so glad I got out of it. I really am.
Tens of thousands of gallons of beer and ale basically pissed into the drains.
No, that would have gone to the staff. Don't you worry.
Well, some of it, of course, would have inevitably. But look at the state of what they're asking people to do. We've got just around the corner on Eccles Old Road. Yeah, Eccles Old Road. There's a pub. It's very near Salford Hospital. And I suppose it's the only place we can go to locally, because pubs, of course, have been hit so bad in the last 20 years as well. And what they're asking people to do to get a drink, there's no way I'm going to subject myself to that, Natalie.
No. At least give it 2 more months, 2 or 3 more months. Like, let's wear out this year if we have to.
Yeah.
I mean, the only place I go into the only time I go into a pub now is when I'm in between doing other stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have a real local, which is why I moved where I am. But I can't imagine too many people would be happy just giving their shit over.
You know? No, no.
The place I had in Croydon, it was difficult enough to get their name and email address for a loyalty card, and that was it. Never mind their phone number, their, you know, time of entry and exit, and, you know, like you said before, sitting with your back against everybody else. I mean, we know that pub...
no live music, no singing.
Table size service is shit. Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. No live music. I mean, there's so many of my friends that are musicians that are just like, WTF. They've got no... It's been
nowhere
confirmed that they have no income now. There's no future for them, basically, unless things actually change, you know.
And no live sport in many places. Well, in fact, I think the no live sport thing, I'm not sure if that's a requirement, but I know from reading the papers that quite a few publicans are so scared of the virus. Some publicans are saying that even though they have paid thousands of pounds to Sky Sports to show the live football, they're saying,
yep,
we won't turn it on because we're scared our customers will be shouting at the telly, go on Liverpool and go on Man City or whatever, and they'll be spreading the germs. This is
just
fucking
crazy. Well, at least
you've
got your priorities
crazy
right there. I am a Liverpool supporter.
Yeah.
But you know what? This year, I know we won it. I'm 34 years old. It's not like I've been waiting for it for
30 years. Yeah.
But it felt like, oh, okay, we won. Okay, sweet.
The joy was taken out of it, wasn't it?
Great. You know, exactly. Yeah. I watched the matches on my home thing, and I was just like, there's no friends here to like celebrate with, at least, you know.
And now you're watching the television and they can use 5 or 6 substitutions. You've got a dickhead running up to the corner flag every now and then to disinfect the corner flag. They're disinfecting the footballs. I do believe that somewhere the people who are behind this are making it up as they go along. Just to say,
and
look at what they'll
some
take.
Some kid in the background pressing boo. Oh, yay.
Yeah. I don't want to live like that, Natalie.
No,
so you just withdraw, don't you? You withdraw and you enjoy the time that you spend with the people you love. You know, I've got the oft-mentioned, we have our dogs and we've got our parks locally, and you just try and ignore it. Apart from when you're working, when you have no choice but to talk about it or think about it. And you just think, well, just do the best you can and just crack on.
Yeah, I think that's the overall message for everybody. In your own little space, Just get on with what you have to as you can.
Hey, listen, do me, just before we go, because I want to get this turned around fairly quickly. Shame we didn't get you on a little bit earlier on. But I want a 20-second WWE-style promo for the Natalie Stacey show on Trigger Warning. Give us a promo for the metal show. Metal is the devil, by the way. I just thought I'd get that in there. It isn't. I love a bit of metal. Metallica is not metal, is it? But anyway, give us a promo. Go ahead.
Well, okay, so quickly, Metallica might be the devil. You've caught me off guard, and I'm like 3 or 4 beers deep. I had 2 or 3 shots.
Get in there.
I play the heaviest that I can. I play a wide range of metal, where it's from the end of the 70s to literally a couple of weeks ago. I tried to play new stuff. Because whenever you're in a community that likes a specific genre, I try to account for everybody. So everyone's always listening to something new. You know, you might listen to something today that you didn't think of, you know, of what the fuck is that band name, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I just try and play, you know, as much as possible to introduce, you know, because I remember that being that person when you have a friend saying, oh, here's a band, here's their album.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, that's changed my life.
Brilliant.
That's bottom line. That's what I try and do. I try and do my best with it.
No, it's good. I caught a bit of it the other evening. And listen, not all the music is my type of music. You know, I'm an old Seeger and Springsteen fan. But it's good and it's presented well. And you can't be listening to somebody who loves the music they're playing. It makes for good radio anyway. So it's triggerwarning.tv. It's Tuesday live at 7 o'clock, but then it's repeated, right? It's repeated later on in the week.
Sundays at 9.
Best of luck with it. I hope to see you again soon when Dubai Hewitt organises another one of these events up here.
I'll be up there like a shot. I don't care.
Yeah, I hope so, Natalie. Lovely to speak to you again today. Great to be chatting with you. Thanks for all the good stuff you do online to promote free speech and free thought. I really appreciate that as well, Natalie. Thanks so much.
No, thanks. Thanks for being the biggest dude on this planet.
The biggest Egypt that ever lived. Hey, thanks for that. Great to talk to you. Natalie Stacey, Liverpool fan and metal impresario. Triggerwarning.tv, live on Tuesdays at 7, repeated on Sundays at 9 o'clock. Great to catch up with her. She's a great lady, really is. Right, I'm out of here. We went over, no harm in that. Back with you tomorrow at 5 o'clock with two guests, lots of chat. Thanks to everybody who phoned in. I really enjoyed listening to you. I mean it, I really did. And we will do more of the phone-ins, make them twice a month or something like that. That's my promise. Right, see you tomorrow. Bye now.